So we all might engage in these behaviors, but only the individual can decide.
Well, then we engage in behaviors that might be have some risk that's like inherent to them, no matter what. But that we also operate in environments of risk that might lower or heighten potential harm. So it's the thing that you're doing, and it's like where and how you're doing it.
Mm-hmm. But those who are engaging in that behavior should have a leading voice from the direct services that are offered to them to the social movements that they are participating in. And so harm reduction began as a drug users' rights movement in the 1970s in Europe and the Netherlands as a response to the extremely high-risk hepatitis C with drug users started a needle exchange program, and then it gained momentum in the USA during the AIDS crisis. And we see it really as an antithesis to criminalization. And I this is my personal understanding of it, and it's kind of a buzzword that is used a lot, but true harm reduction really acknowledges sort of an anti-oppressive framework that acknowledges how criminalization works, the narratives of criminalization, and acknowledges sort of intersectionality in the various environmental risks that are associated with, gender, racial, sexual identities that we have in the society. So, condomless sex is not the same risk for everyone, especially as certain bodies are criminalized and have different access to different sort of materials. Especially social and cultural and economic capital.
Harm reduction came from the streets. So even if it's not necessarily going to be practiced in that space or by people with that experience, that's where it comes from. And if you're ever, we're going to talk about sort of how one can practice harm reduction in areas that are not necessarily sex and drugs. But that anytime you're practicing true harm reduction and using those frameworks and those principles, and your elders are junkies and hookers. And I say that with love, that's exactly what the manifesto is written in veins and in bodies.
Yeah, I know we're using very complex language to talk about it, but harm reduction really is a survival skill that we'll talk about how a lot of us are already using this anyway, and I think it's been formalized, so you guys actually came up with really interesting responses, because a lot of times when we do this, people say needles and helmets, and that's certainly tools of harm reduction, but this way of living is a lot of ways that some of the most marginalized and oppressed members of the society have been adapting, and we use it in a lot of parts of our lives. So before we talk about that, any sort of thoughts or
do you want to go over the intersectionality?
Yes, intersectionality, we felt like that's a really important concept. Is that a word everyone here is familiar with?
I figured for the crowd that would be showing up.
I wish
not
these concepts could be taught in English, but I guess they've all been co-opted by the Academy.
Definitely. Harm reduction seems like kind of terminology that would be used in kind of particular sectors of society as maybe nonprofits and the academy and people who are just in school doing outreach or social work or things like that. And I appreciated that you said that it did come from those places. That it was something else you generated outside of the context. And by actual people really living. Living their lives.
Yeah, because it's in response to a lack of access and to a lack of tools. And there are certain having sex without a latex barrier, especially if you have multiple partners and you don't really know any of them very well, for whatever reason, whether, no matter what reason you're having that sex, yes, there's inherent risk with that, right? But then you have to go about, like, why aren't you using? Like, why isn't the condom there? Why do you not have, like, do you not have access to that condom? Do you have access to that condom, but you don't feel that you have the, in the relationship, that you have the power in that dynamic to use, to have that condom be used? What are you, like, you know, what are you nervous about? Why, and again, they can also go back to, like, why are you having that sex? Are you having that sex for survival purposes? Mm-hmm. You know?
It also provides the risk there. Like, why might you be at higher risk of HIV?
Yeah, I mean, particularly talking about HIV.
Yeah.
But just general, and the same with using, like, pretty much any substance. Like, when you inject something into your body, well, one, if you inject something with a clean pill, then there's just, like, no risk of disease, like, at all. But, like, when you, particularly for, if you're injecting an opiate, you know, for overdose, that risk just, you know, statistically exists. Anytime you're injecting something, a risk for infection statistically exists, but not for everyone, and not if you can get a clean, not if you can get a clean works every time, and not if you can use inside, and not if you don't have to be afraid of what's going to happen if you're caught, right? So harm reduction was in response to, again, like, lack of access and lack of tools. So it really does, harm reduction actually doesn't, ironically, harm reduction doesn't exist without criminalization. If there were no criminalization, there would probably not be a harm reduction movement, and there would be no harm reduction framework. But again, even though that's where it came from, it is possible to have that be, like, a very useful framework and a very useful philosophy to apply in other parts of one's life, and particularly certain behaviors that have nothing to do with these, like, explicitly criminalized activities. And that's also why intersectionality is a huge part of it, though I think in the beginning, and like the particularly like in the 80s, it wasn't necessarily thought of as being part of the sort of like the tenets of harm reduction. But like I think it really is in the past couple years with like this newer generation of activists and providers. I think that's sort of like hopefully being more acknowledged that again we're talking about risk is contextual, right? And so the context is also going to be like your body and like what is, how is your body racialized, gendered, controlled by the state. And so we can't just talk about behaviors anymore. Yeah. Because again, I use drugs. I use a few different kinds of criminalized drugs. I trade sex. I have experienced consequences of criminalization for trading sex. But I don't experience the same kind of thing that people who work outside, people of color, particularly trans women, like, I don't experience any of that. So, like, when taking into account the harm reduction strategies that I need are going to be very different from other people, even though we're both trading sex. And even, again, like, even within the movement, so, like, women who inject drugs have very different needs than men who inject drugs. And that needs to be accounted for. They can't be considered one class.
And that's actually why we, Project Safe, exists. Like there is a needle exchange in Philadelphia, but it is, you know, that it sort of has replicated this power, this sort of male domination where it's very, as 70% of the participants there are men, and it's been
75,
very uncomfortable place for any female identified users to go, so that's why we exist. But I also, I'm in school now, and it's really interesting how harm reduction is given as this, like, theory invented by social workers. And I'm just like, fuck no! A bunch of junkies invented this in the 70s. Like, they didn't fucking publish a paper about it, but let's give them some credit. And I think it's really interesting how, I think, like, as we're preparing for this conversation, or this presentation, we're talking about, like, how so much of harm reduction causes discomfort in people, and it's like this cognitive dissonance where we're just like, but drug users are these like worthless people who don't do anything, and harm reduction is really like does acknowledge behaviors, but that people can engage in positive behaviors, and really the like, tagline is any positive change, and it's I think it like makes people's heads explode to think that drug users can be doing things that are, you know, in this discourse of criminalization are immoral and, you know, like contradictory to like a healthy society, but also still do things that are healthy for them. So
we are.
I was just gonna say like, I guess the whole like lexicon of harm reduction just really is like embedded in that for me is the institutionalized aspect of it. Like, I don't really hear people, you know, outside of the context of nonprofits or even academia using, or like activist-y, like where this kind of vocabulary travels or whatever, like using words like this. And I think I also wanted to say that I think that there's this like morality that's attached to like risk and health, where it's like some things are, there's this implied idea of what's positive and what's negative health-wise, and for me, like looking at the context is about like what that person subjectively is experiencing. Like for instance, with risk, like this person might not be actually taking account of the risks in the situation, or if they do, it would be on their own terms of how they engage with what they believe is like their, what's like what they value, or even if they value their body or their health or whatever. So I guess that was another thing that I thought about when I thought about like institutionalized language of like risk, which is that I don't actually know what that word means unless it's like directly contextualized by a materialized word assessing.
Yeah, I find it interesting that you brought up that people, like, you know, don't know what they're doing, right? And that we, you know, there are certain people that are better at making decisions for other people, that are more qualified to make decisions, and a lot of time it's like, oh, no, I'm doing this for them. And what I find really interesting is that, yes, there are definitely occasions where someone is uneducated, and I use that in the most, like, practical, like, neutral term, in that they literally don't have the knowledge because that knowledge has never been shared or in some way, like, given to them, right? So some people just don't have that knowledge because you don't learn things if no one can give it to you. And if that information, again, think about control of mind by, like, limiting access to information, that information is kept to you, then, yeah, you might not be able to make the most informed decision. But a lot of reactions to that, if we're talking about particularly behavior with drugs and substances, is rarely to just give that person better, more information so that perhaps they can make a more fully informed decision. It's to just make that decision for them. So it's to go into a state of control, because when you're saying that it's not that they don't have the information, it's that they are not capable. And so it doesn't matter if we give them information. So, yeah, it goes from, like, looking at a person's circumstance and what is fact, what is true, that they do not know this information, that they do not know the information about the risk of hepatitis C. But instead of giving them that information and giving them tools, be it facts or, you know, literal, you know, words, the idea is that, no, we're going to take them under our control. And so that is where, like, a lot of people go to. And that is, again, I think that is a state of criminalization, how it really just affects people's ideas about what is best.
Did you ask me?
Yeah, I was going to say, I think there's also definitely like a class aspect to this harm reduction thing, because, you know, if you're a professional person, doctor, lawyer, a cocaine habit or something, you're going to have different needs for that than somebody who, maybe if they could afford cocaine, they wouldn't be doing crack, but because they're poor, they're doing crack cocaine, because that's all they can get access to. And they don't have someone to deliver to them. They have to go on the street to buy it. And they can't afford these different things. Like if their heart stops or something, they can't afford to get that stuff to help them, you know, whatever happens. So I definitely think that, like, for harm reduction, I always think of it as something that it's definitely used a lot more by people who are, you know, working class, poor people. They kind of have a more urgent need of harm reduction than people who just have more material resources where they can just, like, they don't have to worry about the same things, the same problems. So.
I think I also wanted to, like, say that I think the state, like, you know, uses, like, has tools of oppression and, like, basically destroying people's, like, minds and bodies because they want to undermine resistance. And so like when I think about harm reduction, I don't necessarily think about like restoring people to some kind of like better condition of health or something, but as like a way of combating like just a basic survival material assault, like and like psychological material war on like people by the state. And I feel like even, you know, like with Keynesian economics and welfare system and things like that in the 30s and like welfare state in the 60s and 70s, the state kind of learned that if you provide social services and if people are healthy, they and educated, they like resist. So I guess like I also think about it on that level too. It's not just about like.
So it is. You mean that like it's a tool in and of itself for states to sort of like keep people down, basically.
Right?
Yeah.
Or that oppression is.
Yeah, I mean, sometimes just being the number one form of resistance, because I definitely think of like harm reduction as like a form of resistance. I mean, in that like sometimes you're doing shit that is like straight up illegal. The way that we get out works in Kensington and across the city is that level of legal.
Mm-hmm.
But I think just valuing yourself and saying like, I'm worth it. I'm worth doing what I need to do to stay safe. Like, I'm worth calling a number when I have access to a phone to get work dropped off at my house. I'm worth talking to my girlfriends to figure out to share strategies to get our dates to use condoms. Like, I'm worth going to that effort. That is such a powerful form of resistance right there, because you are sent every single message by every institution that you are not worth shit.
Yeah. Because it's interesting how, especially the women we work with, as much like criminalization is something they fall under, but they actually are not allowed to participate in, like when it comes to assault. So it's kind of interesting how it's like this system that they need it, they can't have it, and how they are excluded from this like social contract. Mm-hmm. And we have to sort of work around it. So I'm not sure where we have time.
I think we have here, probably, and there, because we have I think we've
15
minutes.
Okay. So for the final piece, what we wanted to do is kind of, you know, really expand how we can use harm reduction in this sort of framework of thinking to other facets of our lives. And maybe acknowledge the ways we are already doing it, but I think so many times we're either like, it's like, oh, that is like, you know, for academics or social workers, or that's just for drug users and sex workers, and I don't need that, but actually this is a way of thinking that could be beneficial to all of us, and, you know, we all find ourselves entangled in these positions of power and criminalization. Yeah. So
just to, like, get, and we can talk about, I got two examples which we can talk about, or just to, like, sort of give you an idea, talk about anything else. So, like, two examples that I, you know, areas in my life are, one, to maintain or stop using certain substances. It's not just about people that are, like, full-on drug users. It can also be something where, like, that's still part of your life, but you want to change your relationship with that substance, particularly, like, you know, ones on which you are dependent. And also situations in which you are a caretaker or parent, where, sort of like what I mentioned earlier, where like you will be, you're kind of the final decision maker, and you also have certain things that person might not have, like experience in the world. So how can you take a harm reduction stance to that power dynamic? How can you sort of incorporate this idea of like, well, I am, you know, like I'm making a decision that's gonna like control someone else. Is there a way, or even like we did this presentation one time that was about like safer space, how to establish like a safer space, not just like in a physical space, but like in how an organization is run, particularly if you are dealing with the community that we work with, women who are doing street-based sex work. And we had two parole officers. Women parole officers come up to us and ask, like, well, how can we, within the belly of the criminal justice system, are there ways in which we can incorporate criminalization, in which we can incorporate harm reduction So those are sort of just like two examples that might not, that are sort of not, they weren't even thought of when, you know, starting in like the 70s and 80s when harm reduction really kind of became like more of a cohesive movement. But now I hope, I sort of hope that it can be expanded. So I don't know if you guys have like any other areas or like thoughts about those two examples.
Another one, I actually was found this really helpful when I was doing social work. And social workers are really bad at using harm reduction because we're like, the state can save us all. And I had a woman who was in a, you know, experiencing intimate partner violence. And, you know, when I like looked at sort of this sort of systems of oppression that would be impacting her and her partner, recognizing that like a protection order would not, is certainly not the way to go. And having to sort of reanalyze the situation and come up with alternatives, which I think that's really what harm reduction is all about. And then be like, okay, what are my resources here? And really thinking creatively about that.
So what is the kind of work that you guys do with people who come in? Like, is it like trying to help them
like get
access to, yeah?
Well, so we have kind of two. We have like direct services, and then you know, it's sort of Project Safe kind of divides. It's a lot of the same people, sort of divides into two things that we do. And one is like direct services for any woman, trans, cis, doesn't matter. I mean, we do, the majority of the women that we work with are cisgender, and we don't personally offer like trans specific services. We connect them mostly with TIP, but woman is woman, sex work is sex work. And so we do, most of our services occur in Kensington. And we do street-based outreach, which is like walking literally up and down Kensington Avenue and handing out bags that have safer sex supplies, so condoms, lube, things like that, and then safer injection supplies for, so that's, and if you guys are more interested, like we have a table downstairs. And then we also do deliveries of those supplies, but usually in bulk amounts, and that's anywhere in the city. If you, you know, and we do deliveries in Kensington and like Port Richmond and like that area, and then also, you know, North Philly, Southwest, West Philly, we do deliveries all over the city. And
you guys have meetings now soon-ish?
Yeah, we have like 10 more minutes, right?
Oh, you're right.
Because we started late. Yeah.
Yeah, and a big part of what we do, so like what we are doing is meeting material need. Like,
yeah,
there
are the network.
And so with many, like even Prevention Point does this, but like with the distributions of especially syringes, it's there's secondary and sort of tertiary distribution where we bring it to the communities where there's need and then people hand them out where there's a network. And it's an incredibly effective and incredibly illegal way of handing out.
So
You know, like safe way to use drugs that we know people are going to continue to use. And then also sort of like, you know, consciousness raising and just access to information. So like how to date safely. And I think one of the most powerful tools we have is a bad date sheet. So when women get assaulted during transactions and they have historically tried to go to police, they are not able to access the services. In fact, many of them are arrested for making a false report or for any wants they might have.
Or just literally laughed out the room.
Yeah, laughed out the room. So we have a sheet where we sort of distribute to the community we work with that has sort of descriptions of men who've been violent, so they can watch out for them. I think it's interesting, just back to like how this is something that's been replicated. Like there's now an app for women who are sort of recreationally dating that's similar. I think it's called like Lulu. I think Callback Philly has also like replicated that concept.
I came up with an award-winning idea in a contest I had to do at Temple that was for basically an electronic. It was basically Grindr for hookers. Like I just took Grindr and I just like, but all the judges were like old white men, so they had no idea what that was. So I was like, hookers, like. But what I was gonna say, the other thing that Safe does and that we're trying to sort of like do more of is go to events like this and events that are a little more institutional, like AIDS Education Month, seminars and things like that. So we go to
particularly especially Lindsay and I, go to a lot of conferences in Philly and all over the country. We do trainings at different organizations, and a lot of them are the more like institutional, like we're speaking like just to mental health providers. Like I'm doing two at Philadelphia Fight in September. So that's where we're trying to, both because we're some of the only, we're the only organization of our kind, not just in Philly, but like in the general area, and one of a very few in the entire country. So like, this
outside
is
New York.
Yeah, so like this is like this,
this
is our project.
Normal New York.
Yeah.
We're like sex and drugs. People do it. Let's talk about it.
Yeah, so like this is our shirt.
You don't want to talk about it.
From this an organization called HIPS in DC. Like there are very, very few of us. All those organizations are in cities, so women that are in rural areas, I don't know, they really don't have any support. But so, with, so that's one thing we're trying, that's sort of like the other end of addressing access and disparities and like people being able to access things, is trying to get providers that are working with this community, whether or not they know it. Sometimes they know it and that's why they approach us. Sometimes we approach them because they don't know and we're like, yeah, your girls are working. Like, trust
and
me.
And boys. Like, that's, we talk about
yeah.
women because that's what we serve. But
yeah,
like,
that's what we serve, but like obviously
there's
people
this imaginary
I know people I know people, I've literally, I know someone of like pretty much any gender identity that I've ever heard of. I know at least one person, just me personally, that has done sex work as that gender or as another gender when it fit them to be that other gender. Like it is very much pretty much everyone of every category. But yeah, we work with women because that's sort of the most like visible population. And the sort of the more like easy and honestly like easily accessible thing as I said.
Are there any movements in Philly, like sex workers movements, to decriminalize sex work?
We right now we are kind of things have been things have been escalating to increase criminalization. We actually
sorry if this is unrelated to what you had.
No. And yeah, if you guys have any questions,
yeah,
we're just we gotta be done in a few minutes, but like
yeah.
we're just hanging.
I mean,
out.
Just so it's on the, if you guys are interested, please send us an email. But
and what we'll be well actually we should leave this room soon, but we are just downstairs.
Yeah, so we'll be hanging out. But with the anti-trafficking hysteria, it's really paralleling the war on drugs, where there's this sort of, you know, there's certainly coercive situations that happen, but there's this sort of, this like moral panic going on about essentially white slavery. And there's now been a SB 75, which is a bill that increases, has now criminalized sex trafficking, even though like kidnapping and forced prostitution are already illegal. It will make it, you know, if your friend does drive you to do sex work, it could get your friend in a whole lot of trouble. And it essentially empowers law enforcement to criminalize any facet
that
make, of,
makes
the drug,
pimp.
Of the sex trade.
Legal definition of a pimp.
Anyone to be assumed to be in the sex trade. So while we're like trying to have conversations about decriminalization, it's being increasingly criminalized, and the communities that are going to be subject to this criminalization are, you know, communities that are already vulnerable to criminalization. And another way that, you know, there's like these red herrings when it comes to decriminalization, like Dawn's Court, and these are diversionary programs that, you know, are alternatives to incarceration. And but what they essentially do is, you know, people aren't going to jail, even though they still do, but then they're put back in the community and placed on parole for like infinite periods of time. So we're seeing sort of these concrete jails in communities. And
yes,
this
it's
for
still a state control is state control, even if you
yeah.
are not
with drug courts
in
sure.
prison.
Yeah, so, you know, the conversation is, it's like about decriminalization and alternatives to incarceration, but it's still very much relying on the criminal punishment system to manage individual risk, which is really a consequence of criminalization.
So it requires context.
Yeah.
Okay, do you guys have anything else?
Yeah,
do you have like a website or something?
Yeah, it's safephila.org.